This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, a conversation with Jeffrey Toobin from Writers on a New England Stage. Toobin is staff writer for The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN, and author now of four books about the Supreme Court. His newest is The Oath, which frames the last 4 years of the court as a duel between Chief Justice John Roberts and President Obama. Their strained relationship may have begun when then-Senator Obama voted against Roberts' confirmation to the court, a relationship made more awkward when Roberts delivered a botched version of the presidential oath of office at Obama's inauguration.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
The book opens with an account of how that oath went wrong. In short, neither knew when the other would pause. Toobin pieced that story together through emails and conversations from inside the Roberts Court and Obama teams. It is that kind of access to the inner workings of the court, his status among Supreme Court justices, past and present, and his candid, accessible narratives that have made Toobin one of the most respected and readable reporters covering American law today. Jeffrey Toobin shared some insight on the usually secretive Supreme Court with the audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
Lawyers, guns, and money. What could be better? I guess just the money would be better. Hello, everyone. I am delighted to be here in an actual swing state. Gosh, you know, those of us who live in New York, you know, we haven't seen a presidential candidate in decades. It's so exciting to be in a state where you actually see the candidates. And, you know, get to have an actual presidential campaign. It's terrific. All right, let's get to the point right here. Who's my favorite justice? Now, my favorite justice happens to be David Souter. And that's true. Now, believe me, I am not above pandering to a local audience. But it happens even to be true in the other 49 states that he is my favorite justice as well. Let's just talk for a moment about how great David Souter is. I mean, just like stop everything and talk about how great David Souter is. David Souter lives a life of another century. You know, he doesn't have a computer. He doesn't have a cell phone. He doesn't have an answering machine on his phone. He doesn't like electric light. That's true. He moves his chair around his chambers over the course of the day, every day. But the thing about Justice Souter that is so great, other than the fact that he's from New Hampshire, is that he just has this magnificent perspective on what it means to be a Supreme Court justice. Because, like the New Englander he is, he takes his work seriously, he takes the court seriously, but he doesn't take himself that seriously, and he really gets that Supreme Court justices are at once public figures and important people, but not really that well known to the public. And I'll give you an example. You know, for reasons that remain obscure, David Souter and Stephen Breyer are frequently mistaken for each other. Now, if you know what they look like, they don't really look anything alike, but it happens to both of them all the time. And one time, not too long ago, Justice Souter, as he often did when he was on the court, he was driving from Washington to his home then and where. Now he lives in Hopkinton. See, I love throwing around these New Hampshire towns like I know them so well. I went to summer camp in Lyme, New Hampshire, by the way, if I can just, I know it's not that close to here, but I'm going to run out of local references very quickly. So anyway, Souter is driving from Washington to New Hampshire, and he stops in a little restaurant in Massachusetts to get something to eat, and he's sitting there, and a couple comes up to him, and the guy says, "I know you. You're on the Supreme Court, right?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "You're Stephen Breyer, right?" And Souter didn't want to embarrass a fellow in front of his wife, and so he says, "Yes, I'm Stephen Breyer," and they chatted for a little while, And then there was a question that Souter wasn't really ready for. The guy said, "So, Justice Breyer, what's the best thing about being on the Supreme Court?" He thought for a minute and he said, "I'd have to say it's the privilege of serving with David Souter." Now, how can you not love this guy, right? Tragically, as I believe you know, he's now gone from the court, but he's still my favorite. Okay, so let's talk about the Supreme Court by the numbers a little bit. There are 6 men and 3 women. First time in history there are 3 women on the court. There are 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. There are no Protestants on the Supreme Court. First time in history for that. There are representatives of 4 New York City boroughs on the Supreme Court. Sonia Sotomayor is from the Bronx, Antonin Scalia is from Queens, Ruth Ginsburg is from Brooklyn, and Elena Kagan is from Manhattan. Tragically, Staten Island is unrepresented on the Supreme Court, but perhaps future appointments will address that absence. Okay, so those are interesting facts, I hope. Here's an important fact about the Supreme Court. There are 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Now, I'm going to talk a little while longer, but you now know most of what you need to know about the contemporary Supreme Court, because when it comes to controversial cases, the cases that, you know, most of us really care about, the fact that there are 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats really defines the Supreme Court today. You know, a lot of people wish or hope or believe that the Supreme Court is somehow different from the United States Congress on the other side of First Street from the Supreme Court building. But the sad, or not so sad, just the real truth is that they're not that different, that it is politically polarized in precisely the same way. And to see why this moment is so significant in the history of the Supreme Court, I think you need to look back a little bit to the last time the Supreme Court was a unified ideological force. And that was the late 60s, the late 1960s, in the mid and late 1960s, when the court was really dominated by liberals. There were 7 liberals on the Supreme Court, and there was a real liberal agenda. Year after year, you know, the justices wanted to push the law, you know, every year in a more liberal direction. 1964, New York Times against Sullivan, Justice Brennan's famous opinion giving the press important new protections from libel suits. 1965, Justice William O. Douglas's opinion in Griswold versus Connecticut, the case that said states could no longer prevent married couples from buying birth control and creating the constitutional right to privacy. 1966, Chief Justice Warren's opinion in Miranda versus Arizona, revolutionizing criminal procedure and perhaps more importantly, changing television dramas forever. It's like, it's the one right everybody knows they have, right? 1967, perhaps the best named case in Supreme Court history. Loving versus Virginia. What's Loving versus Virginia about? The case that said, it's a case about marriage. A case that says states could no longer ban racial intermarriage. Think about that. 1967. There are people in this room who were alive in 1967. And it was not until then that the court got around to preventing those awful laws. To put it another way, when Barack Obama's parents got married in 1960 in Hawaii, their marriage was a crime in 20 states, and there were people in prison in this country for that crime when his parents got married. And it's worth pausing, I think, to celebrate the fact that such laws are not just unconstitutional today, but literally unthinkable. But you never know how Supreme Court vacancies are going to work. Jimmy Carter is the only president in American history to serve a full term, but not have the opportunity to name anyone to the Supreme Court. There were just no vacancies. But Richard Nixon, he was only president for 5.5 years. You recall he had to leave early. But he got 4 appointments in those 5.5 years to the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Earl Warren, John Harlan, Hugo Black, and Abe Fortas, they all left while Nixon was president. And who did Nixon name? He named Chief Justice Warren Burger, William Rehnquist, Lewis Powell, and Harry Blackmun. And as you think about Nixon's appointments to the Supreme Court, it illustrates something about the Supreme Court, but it illustrates something more important about American politics generally. which is the biggest development of our lifetime, I think, which is the evolution of the Republican Party. The Republican Party of Richard Nixon is unrecognizable to the Republican Party of today. It is dramatically less conservative. And you saw that in the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court in the 1970s, with all those Nixon appointees, was nearly as liberal as it was in the 60s. That was the time that Nixon tapes case. They essentially forced him out of office. They approved school busing. They ended the death penalty in the United States for a time. And, of course, still the most controversial decision of them all, Roe versus Wade, 1973. States could no longer ban abortion. It was a 7-2 opinion. And the only two dissenters in Roe v. Wade were Byron White, appointed by President Kennedy, and William Rehnquist. So three of the four Nixon justices were in the majority in Roe v. Wade. Unthinkable today. And then the changes began in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. And Reagan brought with him to Washington someone who is, I think, a very underrated figure in recent American history, and that's Edwin Meese. Edwin Meese, who was a White House aide and then Attorney General, he said, look, there's been a liberal agenda for a long time. We need a conservative agenda at the Supreme Court. What was that? Expand executive power, end racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, speed up executions, welcome religion into the public sphere, and above all, reverse Roe versus Wade and allow states once again to ban abortion. Another big part of the Reagan revolution was the arrival in Washington of a group of young and dedicated, brilliant conservative lawyers. And who were two of the best and the brightest of those young Reagan lawyers? John Roberts and Samuel Alito. Samuel Alito, in 1985, in a memo plotting litigation strategy in the Solicitor General's office, he wrote, "What can be made of this opportunity to advance the goal of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade?" Later that year, he wrote, applying for a promotion, "I am particularly proud of my contributions to recent cases in which the government has argued in the Supreme Court that the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion." Samuel Alito then, Samuel Alito now. But the party of Ronald Reagan was not the party of today either. And you saw that in Reagan's appointments to the Supreme Court. 1981, Potter Stewart unexpectedly announced his resignation from the court, and Reagan had made a promise in 1980 that Jimmy Carter didn't even make. Reagan said, "If I have the chance, I will appoint the first woman to the Supreme Court." And it wasn't a simple thing in those days, because there weren't a lot of women, especially Republican women, in the traditional pipelines for Supreme Court appointments, circuit court judgeships and the like. So Reagan's people had to go all the way to the Intermediate Appeals Court in Arizona, not even the highest court in Arizona, to find the extraordinary figure who was and is Sandra Day O'Connor. And even then it was clear Sandra Day O'Connor was not a social conservative or a religious conservative. She was a moderate conservative, and that was just fine with Ronald Reagan. 1986, Warren Burger stepped down. Reagan elevated William Rehnquist from Associate Justice to Chief Justice, named Antonin Scalia to that seat. No question, conservative justice. The following year, a real turning point in the history of the Supreme Court. That was 1987, when Lewis Powell stepped down, because he was the swing vote of his day, and so his seat mattered a lot. And what did Reagan do? He nominated Robert Bork. And something very important had happened between the confirmation of Rehnquist and Scalia in 86 and the nomination of Bork in 87. The Democrats had retaken control of the United States Senate, so the chairman of the Judiciary Committee was no longer Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, but instead a young senator from Delaware named Joseph Biden. And Biden conducted hearings that were really an extensive examination of Bork's record. And Bork was brilliant. He was prolific. He was an honorable man, but he was very, very conservative. And the Senate voted him down, 58-42. And Reagan knew he couldn't get someone that conservative through. So instead, to that seat, he nominated Anthony Kennedy, who was then, and to this day, he's no liberal, but he's certainly not as conservative as Bork would have been. And that really set the stage for the Rehnquist Court, which was the subject of my last book, The Nine. And the, you know, when I started reporting about the Supreme Court, I knew some of the history of the court from the Brethren, among other things. You know, the Brethren was all about how all the justices couldn't stand Warren Burger, and there was all this infighting. And that's really been the rule rather than the exception at the Supreme Court. In the 50s, the court was known as nine scorpions in a bottle. You know, William Douglas, the cantankerous liberal who served on the court for 36 years, one summer in Washington, rural Washington State, where he used to have a home, he drove his car off a cliff. He had a terrible car accident. And the first question everybody asked back at the Supreme Court was, where was Felix Frankfurter at the time? Because they hated each other so much, they thought that Frankfurter might have tried to kill him. And I learned, as I started reporting about the Supreme Court, that that was no longer the case, that Rehnquist was actually very popular among his colleagues. Why? Well, among other reasons, Rehnquist engineered a tremendous reduction in the court's workload. The justices liked this very much. In the 80s, the court was deciding about 150 cases a year. By the time Rehnquist died, they were deciding about 80 cases a year. Do the math. 80 cases divided by 9 justices divided by 4 law clerks apiece. It's a pretty cushy job being on the Supreme Court. It's no wonder they live so long, right? You know, in the 80s, the workload had gotten so great that there was actually a serious proposal to add a sort of super appeals court between the circuit courts and the Court of Appeals, and it went to the White House for evaluation. And the White House counsel at the time was a guy named Fred Fielding, and he assigned a young lawyer on his staff named John Roberts to evaluate this proposal. And this is what young John Roberts wrote in a memo about this idea. While some of the tales of woe emanating from the court are enough to bring tears to the eyes, it is true that only Supreme Court justices and school children are expected to and do take the entire summer off. The Chief Justice doesn't talk this way anymore. The entire summer off looks particularly good from where he's sitting, and the court remains a pretty congenial place. And to see that, you need only go to a Supreme Court oral argument. Now, I don't know how many of you have gone. If you haven't, you should. It's really a very entertaining thing. It's really great. And there is, of course, one very well-known fact about Supreme Court oral arguments, and that is that there are 8 justices who are very engaged and very prepared and ask lots of hard questions, and Clarence Thomas never says anything. February 22nd, 2006, that was the last time Clarence Thomas asked a question. You know, those of us who go to Supreme Court oral arguments frequently, we sit there and you can't help but think, will this be the day? Will this be the day Justice Thomas asks a question? And it gives kind of a frisson to every argument because you think it could be, right? It might be the day, but it never is. But the thing is, this is why you need to go. Justice Thomas is not an isolated or unpopular or uninfluential figure at the Supreme Court. You can see it. He sits between Breyer and Kennedy. They pass notes. They tell jokes. They laugh. But he just for his own bizarre reasons, he never asks any questions. Now, when you think about the Rehnquist Court, I think it's useful to think about the court in two parts, 1986 to 2000 and 2000 to 2005. And the dividing point in the history of the court, and in many respects a dividing point in the history of our country, is the court's decision in Bush v. Gore. Now, I admit to being somewhat obsessed with Bush v. Gore. You know, Justice Scalia, outspoken, funny, really great speaker, often does, you know, appearances, and he'll take questions, and he'll get a he'll often get a kind of hostile question about Bush v. Gore, and he always says the same thing. Oh, get over it. Now, as for me, I'm not over it 12 years later. But, you know, my last book before the 9 was Too Close to Call. It was about the recount in Florida. One of the things I tried to do for that book was interview Al Gore, right? I mean, you know, you'd certainly want to interview him if you're writing a book about that. Well, he just wouldn't talk to me. As I was working on the 9, just by a coincidence, I met Al Gore at a social occasion, and he had read Too Close to Call, and we started chatting, and I said to him, you know, Mr. Vice President, you're not going to believe this, but I'm writing another book where Bush v. Gore is at the center of it. I think I'm the biggest Bush v. Gore junkie in the world. And he said, you may be second, which, you know, I think you have to give him a nod on that. But the striking thing about Bush v. Gore is that the Supreme Court moved to the left after Bush v. Gore. Now, as I believe you know, Bush won that case and became president. But then the court became more liberal. That was when they ended the death penalty for the mentally retarded, ended the death penalty for juvenile offenders. They decided Lawrence v. Hardwick, the case that said gay people could no longer be thrown in prison for having consensual sex. They saved affirmative action in the University of Michigan Law School case. And in case after case, they rejected the Bush administration's treatment of the detainees in Guantanamo Bay. So why? Why did they keep moving to the left? Well, remember what I said about the Republican Party. Sandra Day O'Connor, the swing vote of her day, became more and more alienated from the modern Republican Party, George W. Bush. She didn't like the war in Iraq. She didn't like John Ashcroft. She didn't like the way the war on terror was being conducted. And above all, O'Connor was alienated by something that doesn't get talked about a lot now, but by the Terri Schiavo case. Had a big impact on Justice O'Connor, in part because it had to do with the issue of judicial independence, but also because it dealt with the issue of how do you treat a critically ill family member. And that was the time she was dealing with the descent of her beloved husband, John, into Alzheimer's disease. So this was not just an abstract issue for her. But she left the court, 2005, to take care of her husband, and George W. Bush replaced her, and ultimately William Rehnquist, with justices who reflected the modern Republican Party. And the court became more conservative. You saw it in the gun control cases where they said the Second Amendment gives individuals a right to keep and bear arms. You saw it when they ended the school integration plans in Seattle and Louisville. And above all, you saw it in the signature decision of the Roberts Court, which is the Citizens United case, where they revolutionized American campaigns and changed the way money works in politics in virtually every election in the country. And Stephen Breyer, who is no hysteric, said, "It is not often in law that so few have quickly undone so much." Three justices have left in recent years: Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, and John Paul Stevens. Three more different personalities you will never encounter. Sandra Day O'Connor, this tall, outgoing, charismatic former politician from Arizona. David Souter, as I needn't tell you, rather shy and reclusive bachelor from here in New Hampshire. John Paul Stevens, the wily antitrust lawyer from Chicago. But they all had something in common. The three of them were all moderate Republicans who left the Supreme Court totally alienated from the modern Republican Party. Souter and Stevens so alienated that they left their precious seats on the Supreme Court to a Democratic president to fill. And believe me, those choices are very carefully considered by Supreme Court justices. They pick which president they want to give their seats to. And the fact that these two Republican appointees, Souter and Stevens, gave their seats to Barack Obama, yielding Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, tells you a lot about where they felt the Republican Party has gone. All of which sets the stage, I think, for today's Supreme Court. And why don't we talk to Virginia about it? Okay?
Jeffrey Toobin reported live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. When we return, I'll talk with Toobin about his latest book called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, perhaps the most mysterious branch of government, and talk about the justices who've allowed Toobin unprecedented access and even a glimpse of their snack habits.
She engineered the coup of getting a frozen yogurt machine put in the cafeteria, and she is now known by her colleagues as the frozen yogurt justice.
We'll also take questions from the audience when Writers on a New England Stage returns with Jeffrey Toobin in just a minute. You're listening to a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
this. Ha! An innocent bystander. In a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck. Well, I'm down on my luck.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott with a special broadcast of Writers on a New England Stage with Jeffrey Toobin. Toobin's newest book, The Oath, is about the opposing political philosophies of the Obama White House and the Supreme Court under Justice John Roberts. Toobin is a legal analyst for The New Yorker and CNN and has written extensively about the inner workings of the Supreme Court. While Congress and the White House are essentially deadlocked, the judicial branch is steadily knocking down precedents which will have far-reaching effects on American public life. From the Citizens United decision to siding with the president on the Affordable Care Act ruling, Toobin describes Roberts as a powerful crusader for the conservative agenda who's playing the long game. Jeffrey Toobin sat down at the Music Hall in Portsmouth to answer questions from the audience and me about POTUS versus SCOTUS and about what really goes on in the hushed halls of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Jeffrey, we're glad you're here.
Can I say more nice things about David Souter so I can keep getting applause at all times?
Yes, that's what we're going to do the entire interview tonight about. Tell us again about David Souter's niceness. Well, thank you so much for being here. I want to get to the main topic of the oath. Two personalities, President Barack Obama, Chief Justice John Roberts. You talked about in the book about a lot of their similarities. They both went to Harvard. They both made the Harvard Law Review. Brilliant students, charming, great writers. But the distinctive difference in their vision about the Constitution. Talk to us about that.
You know, Roberts, as I mentioned earlier, is someone who really came of age as part of the Reagan Revolution. And the Reagan Revolution, as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, is a real revolution in the sense that he wants to see change. You know, abortion, civil rights, campaign finance, church state. I mean, there is a procession of cases that Roberts would like to see undone, and he is making good, if imperfect, progress across the board because of the fact that there are five Republicans and four justices. Obama, in contrast, is someone who cares not that much about the courts. It's very striking to me. I mean, here's a guy who was president of the Harvard Law Review, who was obviously very knowledgeable about the court. But as he wrote in his book, The Audacity of Hope, he thinks that liberals have relied too much on the courts. He's someone who believes change comes from politics and elections. And he is not someone who really has put a lot of emphasis on appointing judges. Now, he is certainly proud of his two appointments to the Supreme Court, but he has not even filled all the seats that he could on the lower federal courts. And he is very much a status quo type person. And the paradox at the beginning of the oath is that Roberts is the candidate of change and Obama is the candidate of the status quo.
Now, tell us about that, examples of that, because the Roberts Court so far has been burning through precedents. And I wonder what kind of cases they pick up and what are some of the really important precedents that have been changed in this court?
Well, certainly the most important is Citizens United, because Citizens United changed 100 years of law about corporations in politics. But even more importantly than that, it enshrined in constitutional law the metaphor that money is speech, that the act of giving money in support of a political candidate is essentially equivalent to holding up a picket sign or giving a speech on a town square, which essentially can't be regulated. And we have had campaign finance regulation in this country for 100 years, and that metaphor is undoing that regulation.
Well, we have an opportunity then to talk about Justice David Souter again in Citizens United.
Yes.
Because you write about the really what you call a brilliant strategy by Chief Justice John Roberts in this case to delay the argument or postpone the arguments until the next session because David Souter has written a dissenting opinion that would just be scathing to his court. Fill that in for us.
Well, you know, the Citizens United is such a wonderful for a journalist. It's not a value judgment on the wonder whether it's wonderful for the United States, but there were so many parts of Citizens United that were revealing about the justices, about the people involved, about the issues. Citizens United was the first case ever argued in a courtroom by Elena Kagan, who was the Solicitor General at the time. It was the first case heard by Sonia Sotomayor on the Supreme Court. It was the first case in 10 years or more at the Supreme Court that was argued twice. And the reason it was argued twice is that the conservatives were so anxious to overturn precedents that Justice Souter, who, as you know, is not exactly a hysteric person, you know, and the four liberals on the court were so outraged that they were really ready to do a sort of bridge burning. And Roberts, in again, a very crafty use of Supreme Court procedure, he said, okay, I will not go all the way with Citizens United after it's argued the first time. We'll put it down for argument again, but this time everyone will be on notice of just what the stakes are in the case. And so that second time it was argued, that was when Elena Kagan argued it. But by that point, it was essentially a done deal already because they knew where they were going. And that's when they delivered the coup de grace to, you know, all those precedents from recent years.
Have you read Souter's dissent from that?
I have not read Souter's dissent, but it's been described to me. I said, you know, the Supreme Court is a very secret institution, and reporting a book like this is hard. Now, I don't like expect sympathy, and you know, but I'm just saying it's not like you can file a Freedom of Information Act request and say, you know, give us all your rough drafts, and you know. So I have sources I trust. But I don't get to see everything I'd like to see.
Well, I'd love to hear that, this description of what is it like in there, these still, silent marble halls is the way we think of it. But you point out that, you know, the Chief Justice assigns them to the cafeteria committee, the decoration committee.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like being at the office.
The Supreme Court as an institution works somewhat like a university faculty in that except for the opinions, the substantive work, The Chief Justice sort of runs it like the dean, and there are a lot of committees. There's the building committee, and the justices are they care a lot about maintaining the integrity of the building. You know, Justice Souter was on the building committee, and he and Justice O'Connor, they were close friends, and they worked very hard to make sure that they didn't have to put up garish fire exit signs. Justice Thomas is kind of a tech buff, so he's been on the technology committee for a long time. But the least prestigious committee for the justices, and the one that goes by tradition to the least senior justice, is the cafeteria committee. Now, I don't know how many of you have been to the Supreme Court, but there is a cafeteria in the basement, and respectfully, it's not so great. And Justice Breyer, who was the junior justice for 11 years, you know, he worked for years to mediate between the police officers in the court and the construction workers in the court who wanted like meatloaf and mashed potatoes in the cafeteria, and the law clerks who were right out of fancy law schools who wanted tofu and wrap sandwiches. And, you know, that was his judicial work. But Elena Kagan, you know, who's now the junior justice, you know, when she was dean of Harvard Law School, one reason she was so popular is she established a tradition of free coffee for the students and ice skating. And, you know, she's someone who, you know, is committed to the idea of fun. And she engineered the coup of getting a frozen yogurt machine put in the cafeteria. And she is now known by her colleagues as the frozen yogurt justice. So...
Given that, you know a little bit of, you know, the justices, you know the people who work there. I'm wondering, any sense of how they feel about decisions like, for example, Citizens United and how much money has been spent on this campaign, for example?
Well, you know, one of the tragedies of the court, I think, you know, people talk about diversity. And I think, and diversity, particularly when it comes to, say, gender and ethnicity. And I think diversity is important when it comes to gender and diversity, but that's not the only kind of diversity that matters. You know, the court that decided Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, not one of the justices had ever been a full-time judge before. Earl Warren was governor of California. Hugo Black was a senator. William Douglas was head of the SEC. You know, these are people who had led a life in the real world. When Samuel Alito replaced Justice O'Connor, all nine justices were former federal appeals court judges. And O'Connor was the last former elected official on the court. And I think they lost something tremendous with that experience gone from the court. Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about Citizens United, it is one thing to talk about Citizens United as, you know, this abstractions, corporations are people, money is speech. But to have someone on that court who could say, let me tell you what it's like to raise money for a mm-hmm. campaign. Let me tell you what campaign contributors think they get and deserve. That's a tremendous loss for the court, that they don't have someone like that anymore. You know, as for how they get along, you know, they recognize, all nine of them, that they have an institutional interest in getting along. And, you know, the days of nine scorpions in a bottle are long gone. They're very sorry when they lose. Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas were very upset that they lost the health care case. But it's one advantage of having the whole summer off is they get to sort of recover their equilibrium, and by and large, they get along pretty well.
Please tell us about your sources, asks one of the audience. Are they mostly law clerks or the Supreme Court justices, for example?
Well, my deal with my sources, both justices and law clerks, is that I will not identify who they are. What I have said is I spoke to more than half of the active and retired justices and more than 40 law clerks.
Well, a big part of the philosophy of the court now, the philosophy of textualism or originalism in the reading of the Constitution, in direct opposition pretty much to the more liberal view or contemporarily liberal view that the Constitution is a living document. I'd like for you to kind of explain those two for us, the
right.
difference.
Yeah, originalism is a concept very much associated with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. And the idea is, at least in broad outlines, is pretty straightforward, which is the Constitution means only what the framers of the Constitution thought it meant in the late 18th century when they wrote and ratified it. And by that, he means if they thought that they were saying there was a right to privacy that included a right to have an abortion, then that's what the Constitution means. But if they didn't think that, and I think it's safe to say they didn't think that, then, as Justice Scalia says, abortion is an easy case. There is no constitutional right to an abortion. And, you know, originalism conforms very closely with the sort of modern agenda of the Republican Party. A living constitution is more the idea that the society has changed, so the meaning of the Constitution has changed, just as the precedents have changed. The other conservatives on the court are sympathetic to originalism, and they often vote with Scalia and Thomas, but they are not as much originalists. One of my favorite moments in recent Supreme Court history came during a case 2 years ago. California passed a law that said there had to be warning labels on violent video games. And the video game makers challenged that. And Justice Scalia was asking questions of one of the lawyers in the case. And Justice Alito jumped in and he said, what Justice Scalia is asking you is, what did James Madison think about video games? Did he enjoy them? And I think Alito really put his finger on one of the problems with originalism, which is how do you apply the sentiments in detail of the 18th century framers to a world with video games and drones and wiretapping and the internet. That's why, you know, supporters of the living constitution say you have to apply them in a more broad sense than this strict literal view.
Well, you write about, especially after Citizens United, it being a case about Republicans versus Democrats. So what did the Chief Justice do with that? You know, where does he go with that?
Here is where I want to be very clear about the limits of what I know. we know what they did. We know what Citizens United says. We know what the opinion says. But what were they trying to do? What were their motivations? I don't know for sure. But I do know the effect. The effect of Citizens United is to give an enormous gift to the Republican Party. The effect of Bush v. Gore was to make George Bush president of the United States. Now, what I can't tell you for sure is what the intent of all nine justices was in those cases. Was the intent simply to make George Bush president and find some damn reason to do it one way or another? Was the intent to redo our campaign finance laws to help the Republican Party? I can't say that for sure. But I can say for sure Bush v. Gore made George Bush president. And I can say for sure that Citizens United helped the Republican Party. Whether that was the goal of all the justices, that I'm not sure about.
Republicans accused earlier Supreme Courts of judicial activism. George Bush famously did so. How judicially active is the current court?
This is one of the great role reversals that has taken place in recent years. I mean, it is certainly true that the liberals of the Warren era were judicial activists. And I think the classic definition of judicial activism is the unelected, unaccountable judicial branch of government overrules the democratically elected branches of government. You know, classic judicial activist decision is Roe v. Wade. State of Texas passes a law, says no abortions, governor signs it, and the Supreme Court says we know better. Well, that's liberal judicial activism. And conservatives in those days used to say, no, 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 defer to the democratically elected branches. And what we have going on now is a considerable role reversal where conservatives are engaging in judicial activism. Citizens United overruling Act of Congress, McCain-Feingold law, overruling gun control laws passed in D.C. and Chicago, nearly overruling the health care law, all conservative judicial activist causes.
Although in the case of the health care law, you write about Roberts' dual motives here in making that decision. You know, first of all, a personal partisanship and one that had been with him politically for some time, but also a desire to preserve the court as a respectful arbiter. So did it work for him? What's the end result there?
Well, you know, one of the perils of working for CNN, as I do, is they keep the tapes of the stuff you say on TV. So I can't claim that I have a consistent view of this and that I predicted how this all would unfold. I mean, I was incredibly wrong in predicting how this case would come out. But fortunately, I had some time after the decision to sort of reconstruct what went on. And I do think Roberts had multiple motives, because in part, you know, he wanted to see a narrow reading of the Constitution, but he also saw it as the third case in a trilogy with Bush v. Gore and Citizens United. And to have the court again, 5-4, strike down a Democratic goal, particularly on these tenuous grounds, would have really called into question the legitimacy of the Supreme Court and made the court a big issue in the 2012 presidential campaign. And Roberts found a way to step back from that. But I assure you, he did not suddenly discover his inner moderate. You know, he will remain very conservative, and we'll see that sooner rather than later.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. A couple of questions here about how do you see that playing out, you know, under an Obama administration and a Romney administration?
Well, there are four justices in their 70s. There's Ruth Ginsburg, who's 79. Antonin Scalia is 76. So is Justice Kennedy. Is Stephen Breyer 74? I think if Obama wins, Ruth Ginsburg will leave in the next 4 years. She has said she wants to serve until she's 82, which is how old Louis Brandeis was when she left the court. Brandeis is her idol. If Romney wins, she'll say, well, 84 is a better number. I think Justice Scalia and maybe even Justice Thomas will leave if Romney wins. Now that you have four justices in their 70s, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, it might not be entirely up to them when they leave. Mm-hmm. You know, time marches on. One of the weird things with Supreme Court justices is a social pleasantry takes on new meanings. You say, how are you? And you want to know, like, how are you? As far as I know, they're all fine, but, you know, they're getting older, and you never know when they're going to have to leave the court.
You mentioned the, we've been talking a little bit about the agenda of the Roberts Court. If there is one, how about the contemporary liberal agenda judicially? What is that right now?
You know, it's kind of a muddle. It's sort of, well, let's keep Roe v. Wade. Let's keep affirmative action. There's only one issue where there is a clear, aggressive liberal agenda, and that's gay rights.
There's a question about that. Is it an appropriate time in the court's composition for gay rights advocates to apply for certification on the issue of gay marriage? Is it time for gay marriage?
This is a very interesting moment on that question, because there are two cases up for review where the court will decide whether to hear them. They both relate to gay marriage, but they are both quite different. The one is the Defense of Marriage Act case, DOMA, which says even in states that has same-sex marriage, the federal government will not recognize them. You know, under IRS rules, married couples, if one dies, the property goes tax-free to the surviving spouse. Two women are married in Massachusetts. One dies. The IRS doesn't recognize their marriage, so the surviving spouse had to pay taxes. She sued. The First Circuit Court of Appeals said it's unconstitutional form of discrimination. The Obama administration says we agree, the law is unconstitutional. That appeal is before the Supreme Court. What is also before the Supreme Court is the Proposition 8 case out of California. And that is a much more direct challenge to the notion that gay people cannot be allowed to be married anywhere. I think the court will deal with those two cases very differently. I think they will actually take the DOMA case and overturn the law, because Justice Kennedy is the swing vote in that area, and he's the author of the two most pro-gay rights decisions. And I think, you know, DOMA is really very hard to defend at this point, and I think they will overturn DOMA. I don't think they will take the Proposition 8 case, because I don't think they are ready for the political heat that would come from declaring same-sex marriage the law of the land in every state. If they deny cert in the Proposition 8 case, same-sex marriage will become legal in California. That will mean 20 to 25% of the population will live in a state that has same-sex marriage. Four states have it on the ballot this fall. It's going to clearly pass in one or all of those states. I think they will be content to just sort of let the state-by-state process unfold. They're not ready to tell Alabama you have to have same-sex marriage. They'll wait for the Loving versus Virginia moment, but it'll come.
Several people are also asking about Roe v. Wade. I'm sure you can imagine.
Well, I mean, you know, you tell me. I know this is being broadcast on Election Day, but you tell me who won, and I'll tell you about Roe v. Wade. you know, I mean, that's all that matters about Roe v. Wade is who wins presidential elections. That's it. It's really quite simple.
One other commonality, I think, between Barack Obama and John Roberts, both of them, when they came to Washington, they wanted to be uniters, you know?
How's that going?
Well, I want to ask you about, is it possible? I mean, Roberts said that he wants to avoid 5-4 decisions. How many 5-4 decisions have there been?
You know, I am sympathetic to both Roberts and Obama on that issue. What is John Roberts going to do to tell Ruth Ginsburg how to vote? I mean, it's just not his job. It's not possible. And some cases just turn out to be 5-4. I don't think, you know, there's sort of a mythology about the court that, you know, justices can influence each other and, you know, sort of tell each other how to vote. That's a bunch of nonsense. I mean, they're nine very opinionated people, and they vote how they're going to vote.
It strikes me that, I don't know, are you NPR listeners? Many of you people NPR listeners. So you've heard Nina Totenberg. I mean, it strikes me when I was reading your book, I've never heard these justices talk. We know these people as sort of abstracts, characters of their last names. Very little about who they are as human beings.
Well, and that's frankly a big reason I wrote The Nine and I wrote The Oath, is they are human beings. Mm-hmm. And they are, you know, without exception, intelligent and honorable, but they're really different, and they have foibles, and they have eccentricities, and they have very politically active spouses, some of them, but I just think it's the public's business to know some of that.
Well, so I'm wondering if you're willing to play a little personality word association game.
Wow, cool, sure.
I just say the name of the justice, and you say something. So.
Okay,
you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay,
Souter. The best. No. I'm sorry.
I'm just going to ask Souter over and over again,
right,
actually.
No. Justice Alito. Justice Alito. Authoritarian. Very authoritarian. No, I'm sorry.
Justice Anthony Kennedy.
The middle. I don't know. He's a good person.
Okay, we'll establish that they're all good people.
Yeah.
Justice Scalia.
Oh, outspoken, Queens, the guy is like New York. I mean, it's really, one of the fun things about, they're from different parts of the country, and it is fun. Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg really have New York accents. Justice Souter really sounds like a New Englander.
And you say that Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg's families would spend New Year's Eve together.
Every New Year's Eve together. They were colleagues on the D.C. circuit. They're both big opera buffs, and Scalia's funny, and Ginsburg likes to laugh.
Yeah. How about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg? What comes to mind for her?
NFL linebacker. I'm serious. Totally true. This woman, she's like this tall. She weighs about 80 pounds, and she is so tough. She has had every disease known to humanity, but she is just incredibly tough. I mean, that's what I think.
Okay, so Justice Stephen Breyer?
Egghead. He's just like off in the cloud. He's famous for asking very bizarre hypothetical questions during oral arguments that no one can even follow, and he's just very lovable and weird. Yeah.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Pathbreaker in this, and she's got a different job on the Supreme Court than anyone else. If you were to stack up the speaking invitations for all of the justices, they would all be like this high, and Sonia Sotomayor's would be this high.
Whoa.
And she takes it very seriously. And being the first Hispanic justice on the court, I mean, it's not like she's complaining, but it is a tremendous responsibility. It's very time-consuming, and it's just a big part of who she is on the court.
How about Elena Kagan?
Short. It's Thurgood Marshall, for whom she clerked, used to call him her shorty. I was in first year in law school, and some of you may be lawyers. It's kind of a tradition for people to have a study group with a small group of people. And, the people in my study group were Tony Herman, Gail Horowitz, and Elena Kagan, and me. And which just goes to show, if you go to Harvard Law School, someone you go to law school with may grow up to cover the Michael Jackson case. People have said, well, did you expect her to be on the Supreme Court? Now, obviously, there have only been 112 people in the history of the country on the Supreme Court. But if I had to rank the people I knew in law school in terms of likelihood of being on the Supreme Court, Elena would have been very close to the top. I mean, she was a superstar. She's very savvy, very politic in an admirable sense. I mean, she knows about personal dynamics. She's a real force. I mean, but again, how much of a force she's going to be for the next 2-3 decades on the Supreme Court depends on who's the president, who's appointing her colleagues. It all just depends on who her colleagues are.
She got a lot more words, by the way, than Alito.
But I didn't go to law school with
Clarence
her.
Thomas?
You'd have to say silent. But I mean, the thing about Thomas is that I'm sorry, we're now over his one word too. But hey, he doesn't talk, so I get to. The liberals have underestimated Thomas a great deal. People say, oh, he's just a second vote for Scalia. Not true. He is well to the right of Scalia. But ideas that he has brought to the court, like Second Amendment rights for gun owners, like many of the ideas behind Citizens United, like the idea that the Commerce Clause is limited, these are ideas that Thomas has brought to the court and have really become close to the conventional wisdom. So he deserves a lot of credit or blame, as the case may be.
And finally, Chief Justice John Roberts.
The future. I mean, I think he's the future. This is a guy who is going to be there a really long time, and he is poised to be an enormously important justice. But as with Kagan, the real question about Roberts' future is who wins presidential elections, because that will determine how much power he really has.
You're not so economical on the word association game, but an absolutely terrific interview. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
You.
Heaven up the road. Someone gonna hurt you like you hurt me. Wait and see.
Author, legal analyst, and Supreme Court scholar Jeffrey Toobin. He was recorded live here for Writers on a New England Stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. The executive producer and live stage presentation director of Writers on a New England Stage is Patricia Lynch. New Hampshire Public Radio's president is Betsy Gardella. The broadcast producer for this program is Rebecca Lavoie. Associate producer and director of stage communications for the Music Hall is Margaret Talcott. And the live sound and recording engineer is Mike Marchand. Musical director for the stage production is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. To hear other writers from the series, visit nhpr.org and click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thank you so much for joining us today for a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Like you mistreat someone, someone's gonna mistreat you. Now you're laughing, pretty baby. Someday you're gonna be crying. Now you're laughing, pretty baby. Someday you're gonna be crying.